Today, economics. Is it broken? Hello again, it's Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics, World Notice Post, covering finance and property news with a distinctively Australian flavour. Today, I'm joined again by George Gowan. Hi, George.
Hey, Martin, what's going on, buddy? Saying hello to you from beautiful St. Bart's, although it's not too beautiful today. We had like a hurricane. You want to hear a funny story? As I came here because I was in lockdown in Medellin for so long. So I'm like, I got to get some freedom. So I text Hugh Hendry, who's, from FinTwit, the hedge fund manager who lives here, and I know him reasonably well. And he said, yeah, everything's open up, the gym. So I came out here. The problem is I had my driver's license stolen about 6 months ago. Yeah. So the only thing they'll let me rent on the island is this little 50cc scooter. Like they had in Dumb and Dumber. So you're like, going around like this. And today there's like a 60-mile-per-hour wind. And the rain's coming down like sideways. And I'm trying to get to the store because, of course, like a dummy, I didn't go last night and stock up on any food. So I'm in there with just a T-shirt that's just soaking wet, my shorts, and like some flip-flops, trying to drive in the rain when it's like pushing me off the side of the road and in the ditch. And it was just crazy. So that's been my day today.
I think they call that a modern day problem, right?
Yeah, exactly right. St. Bart, that's right.
And actually, it's quite a good analogy for what's going on with the economy, isn't it?
Yeah. Boy, that's a good point. It sure. Guys, we didn't plan that at all. That was very good, Martin. And I hear that's what's going on right now, pretty much with the Aussie housing market. And you guys are pretty much on a 50cc scooter. And you're riding into a 100-mile-per-hour hurricane.
I mean, it is remarkable, And we've had a couple of discussions in recent months about, the limitations of the central bank's ability to do things and what have you. But the crosswinds that we're seeing here, and indeed around the world, are actually quite remarkable. And, it gets me asking the question, are the basic fundamental assumptions about the way economies work actually broken? And give you an example, right? We just had our first CPI number in 79 years negative, right? So we actually have got, in the official numbers, deflation. Now, there are some one-off numbers in there, but the whole idea of targeting 2-3% inflation is just, impossible. And in fact, the central bank here has not been able to do that, achieve that objective for years and years and years and years and years. So the fundamental targeting of inflation is bust. We also have got another really interesting issue, which is that essentially the regulator yesterday came out and said, the banks will allow you to pay up to 50% of your income in dividends, right? And I'm thinking, hang on a moment. So who is now setting dividend policy? The regulator. Free markets? No, the regulator's doing that. And then if you look at the way that the banks are actually being funded at the moment, they're actually accessing really, really cheap funds via the central bank here, 0.25% for 3 years. So essentially what's happening is that essentially the central bank is raising funds. Those funds are being then flowed into the banks. The banks are then using those funds to pay their dividends. Now, that is not free market, is it?
It's not even close. And this is kind of like a PR thing that I want to start focusing on. And I actually had this conversation today earlier with Ron Paul, and he couldn't agree more that out in the world of, let's say, Marxism or soft Marxism, whatever you want to call what's going on in the United States right now with these riots and looting, you can say it's about one thing, but really at the heart and soul of it, it's about more socialist type of policies. And they always talk about capitalism, the evil, the capitalist and the capitalism. And it's kind of a word that's easy to not like. The people with capital, they're the only ones that have an edge, or they're the only people that succeed. I'd like to start replacing the word capitalism with the words free market. Because I think it's a much easier sell, and it paints a better picture for the average Joe and Jane to say, well, do you want free markets? Well, yeah, of course. Do you want the freedom to choose? Yeah. Oh, yeah, I want that. Okay. Well, but that's at its core, as you know, that's capitalism, private property, and giving businesses the right to not only succeed, but more importantly, the right to fail. And that's what is really missed when we look at the bailouts, you know, going back to 2008, 2009, I'll take it to the U.S. All these people that are kind of have that anti-capitalism type bent, they always say, well, look at that. That's an example of capitalism in its worst form. We just can't trust it because that's the result. Where you and I know that that's not an example of capitalism. That is the opposite of capitalism. Capitalism, and I think Milton Friedman said this, where the profit and loss of a business, the loss is far more important than the profit. Because if you allow these businesses to fail, and I don't care how big they are, I don't care if they're a bank, if they're a AIG or an entire industry, what happens is you penalize the individuals and the businesses that managed their affairs well. What should happen is the AIG should go bust, and XYZ company that didn't go bust should come in and take over their assets. And even if they have to go through a Chapter 11 bankruptcy, I'm not sure if it's I'm sure there's something similar in Australia. Yep. There's a difference between Chapter 7 and a Chapter 11. But that's when the good actors, the people that were prudent, that's when the assets go to those individuals that can manage it better moving forward. What we do is we bail everyone out, and then we create moral hazard. So these bad actors not only are still there, but they're even more incentivized to do worse and worse things moving forward, because now there's this backstop. So why shouldn't I go further and further out the risk curve? Why should I invest in research and development? Why should I invest in CapEx? Why shouldn't I just buy my own shares back? I mean, that seems like the easiest way and the with the least downside, the least risk to getting rich, not only for myself, but increasing the share price for all my shareholders and the people with the assets, again, going back to the 1%. It's a totally perverse system that I'm getting very frustrated, as you can probably tell, with people referring to this system as capitalism. And it's the furthest, I'm not going to say it's the furthest thing from capitalism, but it's not even close. What we have here is corporatism. And another PR thing that I really want to point out is you know, these people that are out there protesting and rioting, their anger is generally directed at these giant corporations that owns their own dry cleaning store, or it's the person that owns the restaurant, or it's the person that owns the little chain of three or four Subways, where the owner is sitting there working and running the cash register and working 10 or 12 hours a day. That's capitalism. And if you look at the job creators in our society, it's the small and mid-sized business. It's as far as you look at the aggregate total, that's the majority of job creators. It's not these giant corporations like J.P. Morgan or even like Google or Facebook. It's the mom and pop shop. And so when people are putting down capitalism, they're basically saying that they want those individuals that everyone knows in the community that are hardworking and creating jobs, they want to bring those people down. It doesn't make sense when you think it through.
No, absolutely. And, there's a couple of observations. The first is it should be symmetric. In other words, there should be the ability to get capital to create additional wealth, but also there has to be downside, there has to be risk, there has to be the chance of failure. Whereas, as you say, at the moment, basically, the central banks and everybody else are supporting everybody, so they don't want any of the big corporates to fail. So that's the first point. The second observation is we've got more than 3 million small businesses here in Australia. And of all of the sectors that need support at the moment because of COVID and the lockdowns and all those things, it's the small business sector that is hardly getting any support. So there was a $40 billion program of lending that was actually announced some time back to support small businesses. About 1.5 billion of that was taken up because, one, the banks didn't want to lend, and two, the terms and conditions were just impossible for many small businesses to comply with. It was just too risky. So there is very little support here in Australia for the most critical engine in the economy, which is the small business sectors, because the small businesses have an opportunity to turn into bigger businesses, and that, of course, is what you want. But at the moment,
compete with the big corporations.
Yeah, exactly. But at the moment, what we've got is basically some large organisations who actually have taken extreme risks, like the banks, lent way more than they should have lent at much higher ratios, and then blow me, the central bank, the financial regulators will come in and say, no, we'll protect you because of, quote, financial stability. And in the process, people haven't realized that, you know, as you say, the free market has just gone completely out of the window. And I agree with you. We should be talking free market, not capitalism. The fact is that we need the capital that's in the economy to be directed to the places where it can actually grow and expand in proper, real terms, not these artificially created monstrosities we've got at the moment.
Yeah, exactly. And you have to kind of ask the question, is the government, do we need the government to do that? Because isn't that really the function of the banks to actually create bridge loans for companies who have a great business model, who are typically profitable, but they've just got a hard maybe 3, 4, 5, 6 months. That type of lending already exists. We don't have to have some sort of government concoction to create that. But one thing I want to kind of try to unpack with you, Martin, because I think it's kind of an interesting thought experiment, and it's something I really mull over often, is would we have such a big problem if we wouldn't have had constant inflation over the past, call it, 100 years? I'm sorry for being U.S.-centric here, but taking it back to the Federal Reserve in 1913, if you look at a chart of inflation, and actually prior to the 1930s, you see it's kind of like a heartbeat. It just, we have inflation, deflation, and it kind of just levels out to where we just have kind of this slight deflation, where prices of goods and services are actually going down. And to me, if you talk about consumer goods, the price is going down, for most people, you'd think, well, that would benefit them. That would increase their standard of living. If you go back to 1800 to 1900, for 100 years, prices went down by 50% during those 100 years. So if you're just making the same amount of money, and by the way, nominal wages went up, especially at the end of the 1800s, but your standard of living is increasing dramatically. So my point there is, if you think about what inflation or constant inflation, even if it's 2 or 3% per annum, does to the psyche of the average person, it forces them into risk assets. Because, you know, you're going to have typically a negative real interest rate. So if you're putting your money in your bank, you're going to lose purchasing power over the long run. So you see all your friends out there that are getting rich as a result of having their wealth, let's call it, in a 401k or their house or something like that. So what they have to do is they have to take their money out of where it's the safest, let's say, in an old school type bank. Or maybe even in a treasury, and I know that those aren't safe anymore, but back in the old days. And then you've got to go further out the risk curve, right? And then you get subject to these boom and bust cycles, where if you can imagine the late 1800s having 3% deflation per year while nominal GDP and wages were going up. See, that's the big key there. Because when you say deflation to everyone, they're like, oh, the average worker's doomed because they're all going to get fired and wages are going to go crashing down and you're going to have this black hole type of scenario where we just, you know, it's this doom loop that we never get out. And but think about that. Wages are actually going up in nominal terms while prices are going down compounded. So what happens is and by the way, interest rates, nominal rates back then were 4%. So you could just put your money in the bank. And you could make 7% real return every single year with just doing nothing. So what this does is I think it would create a society, not just individuals, but small businesses, large businesses, and these huge corporations that would save a lot more money, and they would take less of their money and put it into risk assets that could crash, that could go up, that could basically subject to all these boom and bust types of cycles that are exacerbated by the central banks in this lending. So I want to pose that question to you quickly. Do you think we would be in as bad of a shape or in as bad shape now as we are if we didn't have this perverse incentive structure and people actually had a lot more savings because they could make money with a savings account?
I agree with you, absolutely. I've always believed that this, targeting 3% or inflation, right, is absolutely nuts, right? Because what it is doing is it's building in a problem into the economy. And I know all the major mainstream economists say, no, you need that because a bit of inflation is good. Why? I've never seen a really good argument as to why actually it's the right thing to do. And bear in mind, of course, that targeting inflation was at a time some time back when inflation was raging away and they were trying to get inflation down. Now, that might have been appropriate for that point in time because of the particular inflationary pressures that they were dealing with. But over the long term, actually, it's not good policy. And I actually think that you're spot on, that if we actually had a more, level playing field, as it were, it creates much more opportunity to get capital to do the things that it should be doing, which is to create the innovation and, the new business models and all of those things, rather than just chasing our own tail. So I absolutely agree with you. But I'll tell you what, that is not a mainstream view. And most mainstream economists and, those in the banks and those who keep talking about this thing say, no, we have to go back to targeting, 2 to 3%. And the Reserve Bank will ultimately get inflation up to 2 to 3%. Why? I mean, ask the more fundamental question. This is not actually necessarily the right way to drive the economy.
Yeah, and the insanity there is to assume that the central banks can just pinpoint with that accuracy this 2 to 3% and hit it. I mean, look at the BOJ. I mean, they can't get they've done just trillions or quadrillions of yen in quantitative easing, and they can't get inflation if you believe the numbers. And I would argue in the U.S., the CPI is totally cooked. So they're sitting there trying to get this 2% when really it's humming along at maybe 8 or 10%. I don't know how it is in Australia. You know, one thing I used the other day is the Big Mac index. Have you seen that,
yes.
Martin?
Yes.
Where if you compare the Big Mac index, the price of a Big Mac in 1986 to where it is today. Or I'm sorry, this chart I had was to 2012. So from 1986 to 2012, the price of a Big Mac went up by 173%, while the CPI went up by 110%. Yeah. So I know that's just one little data point, but it kind of makes you wonder.
And I'll tell you something else. If you got a tape measure and measure the size of the Big Mac now, relative to what it was 20, 30 years ago, it's now probably half the size.
Yeah.
So you're actually paying a lot more for a lot less.
Americans are twice the size, so how do you account for that?
They've been eating more of them. So just to answer that specific question, yeah, the CPI, as officially reported, has no connection with the real experience of households here in Australia. My surveys are showing that 98% of households are saying over the last year, the cost of living, the cost of the things I have to buy from childcare, electricity, and even food, has gone way through the roof. It's about 7, 8, or 9%, right? So the official numbers, as fudged, and they fudge it because they exclude housing from the CPI number. They apply this sort of adjusted, in other words, when you buy your next TV, because it's got more functionality, that they then write that value down. So effectively, everything is being written down. This is a global fraud, right? Because if you look in the US, if you look all around the world, they all follow the same basic logic, and they're all basically doing the same thing, which is under-reporting real price indices and their growth. And then they go and target it.
Yeah, right. Then they target it. And then also, too, if you really think that through, the reason they need to, in my opinion, the reason they want inflation, or at least to try to let it run hot, whether they can achieve that or not, that's a different topic, is because they need to generate more tax receipts. So they need to pay back their nominal debt with cheaper dollars or cheaper currency units. And so the way you do that is you get prices just moving up in nominal terms, and that is supposed to create more tax receipts. But what the problem is here, Martin, especially in the United States, and I don't know if we discussed this last time, so forgive me if we did, but if you can have, or I've done a whiteboard video where you can show how inflation would go up while at the same time the tax receipts would actually go down. And because let's just assume that there's a lot more people now in the United States that are on unemployment than there was 6 months ago. I think that's a safe assumption. Mm-hmm. Well, the unemployment checks are though they're taxed on the income, they're not taxed through payroll taxes because they're not a paycheck. And 50% of the money that comes into the federal government is through payroll taxes. So you could see this situation where tax receipts are actually going down. But if they're, but going back to the original topic there, if they're running at a 10% inflation rate, let's say, and their deficits are still just wildly out of control, then that means that there's no way for them to ever pay down these debts if they've already got inflation running at that clip, unless they get inflation up to some extreme number, like 20 or 30%. And if because if they're not getting it down at 10%, they've got real problems moving forward. And what that means is that most likely the deficits are just getting bigger and bigger and bigger. But I know you guys don't have as much of a problem with that as we do in the United States. I think the last time I talked to you guys were about 50 or 60% of GDP, debt to GDP there, where in the States, my goodness, we're going to be, I think we're going to be at probably 150% within the next few years.
Mm. Yeah, well, we're looking at 50 or 60% here. And in fact, the Treasury issued a report quite recently, which basically said, yeah, we're going to have to borrow big, you know, $850 billion, I think, is the target. And we overall, and that's a big number, that's a huge number. But then they went on to say, well, of course, you know, we'll be able to manage that because our growth rate will be growing much faster than the interest rate on the debt that we're actually borrowing. So therefore, over time, we'll be able to, you know, take that down again, right? So that's and it goes back to your point. Well, yeah, you need inflation, because if you actually have inflation, then the debt gets less relative to the rest of the economy. But the fundamental point there, George, is that all of this is predicated on GDP, right? On effectively the, you know, what are you measuring? You're measuring total activity in the economy, never mind whether it's good activity or bad activity, whether it's actually productive or non-productive activity, it's activity, right? And so basically you've got a predicated target of growth based on GDP. You've got a set of targeting based on a CPI that's completely nutty. And by the way, it's also allowing unemployment, because effectively the big variable here is actually unemployment, right? Because in this model, basically, yeah, you can borrow more and try and put more money into the economy. But actually the leverage point is people who are out of work. Right. So effectively, in a downturn, you have more people out of work. And in Australia, we're going to be looking at unemployment at about 9.5% by the end of the year. We had about a 5% number, you know, in February. So that's just huge. And that's, you know, dramatic. And I just think, well, hang on a moment. If we really are saying that the number one objective is GDP, that the way to do it is to borrow more and support the, you know, the large organizations, as we've been doing, and the variability here is unemployment, then that tells you a hell of a lot about the basic assumptions that those in power prioritize in terms of importance, right?
Yeah, and how unsustainable it is.
Well, that seems to be the point. And then here's the next point. If you overlay then the fact that we've got automation and we've got essentially more and more jobs over time being replaced by, you know, robots and computers and all of those things, this whole concept of having spare capacity, in other words, people not doing much at all, if anything, and using that as the variability to control everything, which is what's happening, seems really weird if you stand back and think about it.
Yeah, and I really am torn on the argument of robots or AI or anything replacing a lot of jobs. I see that short term. I totally get it. I understand how if you get self-driving semi-trucks, that the truck drivers are going to be out of work, and that's a huge deal in the United States or probably in most economies. But what I don't really buy into is that long term, that's an issue. I think it's a good thing. I mean, this is not the first time this has happened throughout history. And it's happened in a bigger scale. People say, well, yeah, this time it's different because this is just going to change everything because we've got Moore's Law or whatever it is. But if you go back to, you know, at a certain point in time in the United States, I would call it 100 years ago, a little more. I mean, 90% of the people were farmers, for heaven's sakes. I mean, so what happens? Or you've got the horse and buggy. You've got the vehicle. You've got all these times throughout history where you've had this new technology come in and wipe out like 50% of the jobs. And somehow we as human beings always discover that we want more. We always, there is no limitation on the wants and desires of human beings in general. So yes, if we could get robots to do everything that we're doing right now, that would eliminate jobs. But I can almost guarantee you that we as a race or a human race are going to find other things that aren't being produced right now that need to be produced by actual people that we want, that we don't want today because they don't even exist. And it also unleashes a lot of human potential in other areas. I mean, you look at, we'll go back to farming, right? When we had kind of crude mechanisms for growing food, it was, you had to work 10 or 12 hours a day just to produce enough food for you and your family. Where you bring in all these technologies, now all of a sudden one farmer can produce enough food for 100 people or 1,000 people. And it frees up those 100 or 1,000 people to go off and do other things like being a doctor or being a school teacher or maybe inventing the next automobile or you know, whatever it is. So I don't think people really give enough credit to not only human ingenuity, but human needs, wants, and desires. It's kind of that Malthusian mindset. I just have never bought into that too much.
Yeah, well, you see, I was going on to say that the trick here is to recognize that what you're talking about is actually what has always been, right? Go right back to the Stone Age. We've always been ingenious. We've always been innovative. We shouldn't stop that. Right. But what we have to do is to recognize that that means that there's a challenge in terms of making sure that, you know, the nature of work will change. That means that the nature of education needs to change. It means that the nature of supporting people as they migrate from one role to another role, all of that stuff needs to be thought about to be able to facilitate the process. We shouldn't stop it. Right. And I'm a great fan of technology and a great fan of the opportunity that it creates. In fact, if you think about it, there are probably less people today doing really horrible jobs than 3 or 4 centuries ago, right? Okay. Because there's more technologies come. So we shouldn't stop that. But what we should do is recognize that if the variability in this whole economy is unemployment and the human cost of that. You know, and by the way, it's just differentially spread quite often to younger people at the moment. That is an absolutely wasted set of resources. And frankly, people, will find for many years, because the unemployment rate will not go down quickly. It's going to take years to work through, unless we have different policies and different strategies. So I think that training and education and all of those things are absolutely fundamental. But I don't want to stop the rise of the robots, as it were, because I think that will create lots of opportunity. Only, though, if it is actually in policy and if people who are in power are thinking about it right. And frankly, they're not at the moment. I mean, give you an example. And there's a lot of discussion down here, I'm sure is over there as well, about MMT, right? About the modern monetary theory, which basically says, well, a government is not like a private household. They can basically, if you own your own currency, you can create as much currency as you want. Sure. You can basically then invest that. Now, I would say, yeah, okay, well, you can, but you got to decide where you're going to invest it, right? Because essentially for them, the variability is not unemployment. So they would say, we want to give everybody a job who wants a job, right? And it doesn't matter what the job is, any job's a good job, but we'll make sure that everybody can get employment. And so basically full employment is their number one objective, right? To do that, they then basically will allow the debt to expand to be able to do that. So there's a different set of priorities there, right? And that means that it isn't the variability of jobs that is actually the leverage point, it's actually debt, right?
Yeah, and I'd take it a step further too with the MMT people. They're, and listen, I agree, as far as the way that MMT folks describe the monetary system, I agree with almost 99% of it. I think there's some things they don't think through too well, such as the TGA and the banks creating money and the government creating money, and then the euro dollar system. I don't think they're plugged into that at all. Yeah. But I totally agree with a lot of what they say. But where they start getting into policy is where I disagree, because and I want to point out to all the Austrian folks watching this, or you know, kind of the lean on that side, the more free market side, and look at MMT. Oh, that's crazy talk. Yeah, but a lot of them, like Kelton and Mosler, will admit that, listen, you can print all this money, that's right, but you have to have the productivity to match the money creation. If you don't produce more goods and services and all you do is produce more green paper, it doesn't matter if it's the dollar or who produces it, you're going to see inflation. It's going to be bad. I think where I disagree with them is they think the government can come in and create these jobs that will be productive to the point where it would compensate for the additional money growth. And I don't see that happening, because I just look at everything that the government touches, everything that it runs, and I'm not gonna say everything, but 99% of it, it's extremely inefficient. It works a lot less well than something in the private sector. But I also wanna touch on what you were saying there. And in order to get from A to B, you're talking about the correct policies, and we can transition into this new world where technology is really growing at rapid levels and it's improving our standard of living. And I totally agree with that. But I would say that it just goes back to free market capitalism. If you come in here and let entrepreneurs do what they do, that's what they're good at. And I'm not the person saying this. Look at Marx. Look at Karl Marx. He even said that capitalists are extremely efficient. And he went so far as saying they're even too efficient, and that would be this late-stage capitalism that I've talked about in a few of my videos, that a lot of Marxists feel as though we're in right now, where capitalists just start – they kind of feed on society as a whole because they can't push the ball any closer to the goal line. But he even admits that these people, these producers, as I like to call them, they're very efficient. But if they're strapped down by rules and regulations and all of this crony capitalism that we're seeing right now in corporatism, you're not going to unleash the power for them to go out, pursue their own self-interest, and do what they do. If we had an open free market, let's go back to the late 1800s, and I know there's a lot of problems with the Industrial Revolution, but one great thing is you're pretty much free to fail back then. There was no government coming in and bailing you out or anything like that. You could fail. You could do pretty much whatever you wanted. We had no income tax in the United States. So if we could go back to a system like that, I think that would give these smaller entrepreneurs, the guys that are and gals that are small now, the opportunity to compete with these big guys, create new industries, and to really fill that excess capacity that we might have in the labor pool as a result of technology taking down some other business. But like right now in the United States, you can't even start a lemonade stand. And I mean, people think that that's, you know, it's kind of funny or whatever, but it's true. Like when I was a kid, you'd go out there and just set up a little table on the corner. We live in the suburbs, and you just set up a sign, and it's kind of just what kids do. You know, they learn how to manage money and how much is my sugar going to cost, how much are my lemons, my water, and all these things. But now you try to do that, and you're going to have like, oh, the police are going to show up in a tank, and they're going to, you know, you're going to get maced. They're going to come in with this black ops helicopter and fall in, you know, on these ropes and everything. I mean, it's going to be complete madness. And it's just, we've got to get rid of that. And if we don't get rid of it, if we have more and more regulations, more and more rules that restrict human ingenuity, then I agree that this technology is going to destroy a lot of jobs. and it's going to make things a lot worse. And then, but the answer definitely isn't UBI, because then you see, you've got to look at the psychological component of that as well, right? And I really worry. On paper, I think it works. I think it works really well. But what I don't like about it is, I know just from my own experience, and this may be just me, I could be an anomaly, but if I was in a position where there was no hope, where I was reliant on someone else or some other entity, I would be a tenth as productive as I am. It would be depression. It would be, there's just no reason to get out of bed in the morning, right? And I think that when people get on welfare for long periods of time, especially if it's generational, right, to where they feel as though this is my life, there's no reason for me to work harder, because if I do work harder, I'm just going to be held down by the man or the corporations or whatever boogeyman is out there. And then we give the people this money coming from, it's almost like a maternal type thing, where we're treating adults as though they're children. Yep. Into their 50s, 60s, or, you know, from cradle to grave type thing. And then I really, really worry about social unrest, and I worry about productivity. And one thing, I was listening to Jordan Peterson the other day on an old show he did with Rogan. And, you know, he's not an economist, but he's one smart dude. And he was talking about this from a psychological standpoint. And he pointed out with Brett Weinstein that it's not necessarily the level. When you have social unrest and when you have a wealth gap, it isn't necessarily the level at where the quote unquote poor are. It's only the delta. So you could have the quote unquote poor making $100,000 a year. But if the delta is severe enough, you're still going to get more and more social unrest. And that goes back to that psychological component that I was referring to, that I'm really just parroting from Jordan Peterson and Brett Weinstein on the Rogan show. So I think that makes things even more complicated.
Yeah, no, that's very interesting. And look, UBI, I think, is worth exploring. I mean, I spoke to Guy Standing some time ago, who's one of the advocates of that, and he said, "Look, there is definitely evidence that it can change the psychology of people if it's done in the right way. Often, it's not being thought about in the right way." But the point I wanted to make here is there's something else I wanted to highlight. You know, as we go through some of these crises and some of these difficulties, there's so much more talk now about mental health, right? And about the fact that, you know, people need to take a pill to get them through. My argument is mental health is being used as a proxy to not address the fundamental structural issues that we've just been talking about, right? That there's something very, very important here that says, yeah, keep blaming the individual for the problem, not blaming the structure of the way that the economy works and the assumptions that are making it work, right? And I think that more and more that we are being driven into this view that it's a personal issue for me as you know, if I can't get a job, it's my problem. Or, you know, if I haven't got enough money, it's my problem. Without standing back and saying, what's caused this, right? What are the structural issues? What are the structural assumptions around the economy that are actually driving this? And to my mind, if we just pull it back and say, no, it's just a personal issue, it's a mental health issue, we've missed the critical structural issues that we've been talking about today.
Yeah, and I would take it a step further. And I mean, I like the rugged individualism, and I don't think that's what you're talking about, but I'd point the finger at the government. I think the real problem is when they come in and say, well, the problem is with you, Martin, but the solution is with the government. Yes. All we need is just a little more government control. Yep. We need a little more regulation. We need to steer the economy this way, a little bit more this way. We need to micromanage, and then we're going to solve all of those problems that you're creating for yourself, because you're just too stupid and you're just too dumb. You don't really get it. It's these global elites that need to do all the thinking for us. You know, I was watching this World Economic Forum thing the other day with, I don't know if it was in Davos or something like that, but this is just utter nonsense. And it's actually quite disturbing.
Yep.
And regardless of whether you agree with their, I guess we could call them objectives or not. I don't think that's really the point. The point is how they're trying to roll this out in their mentality. It's this mentality that we, the elite, are so much smarter than all you fools down there and all you peasants and all you plebeians, that you just need to just trust us and we're going to steer the entire world in the direction we think it should go. And if you guys just submit and obey to what we think is right, what we think is fair, what we think is just, then everything's going to be okay. And you see, the problem with that, obviously, is when that has been tried in the past, that's when you get some really bad dictators that get into power, and we have some severely troubling outcomes, to say the least. And what's bizarre, too, if you look at the watch the people that, and I know this isn't scientific data or anything, but I challenge anyone to watch this guy that's in charge of it. I think his name is Klaus Strobe or something like that. But tell me this guy isn't a Bond villain. I mean, seriously, I would challenge anyone to watch 30 seconds of this guy talk and say, yeah, that guy is not some sort of devious Bond villain. But it's every one of them. They look like they're robots. I mean, it's almost like, you know how Alex Jones talks about the reptilians and everything? Yeah, I mean, he's such an entertaining guy. Whether you buy him or not, it's like WWE. You know, I mean, it's just pure entertainment. Yeah. But it's like these reptilian people that are talking about that they're really not human. They're more like robotic or whatever they are. And it's just bizarre. And when they're talking to the camera and they're doing these videos, you can tell they're reading right off a script. So it seems so unnatural and so plastic and just so creepy. And and see what else is really, really wild. I should pull this up right here. This Klaus guy, let me read this to you. This is from his actual report from the World Economic Forum. He wrote this. This is him here. He's endorsing this. He says the pandemic represents a rare but narrow window of opportunity. Opportunity to reflect, reimagine, and reset our world. Yeah, I don't know that. What do you think about that stuff? That gives me the creeps.
Yeah, well, look, I've had this view for a long time that the World Economic Forum, the IMF, the Bank for International Settlements, those global bodies, right? They're all populated with a set of ideas and, frankly, a people that say, we know better than you. We'll tell you. We'll dictate down to countries. And so basically, implicitly what they're saying is, we're going to pull the levers and everyone's going to follow us, right? I am very, very concerned about that. Now, I don't necessarily hold the conspiracy views that some do, which is to say that there is this world order and they've got a plan and they're executing it. I'm not sure it's quite like that. But I am concerned about the fact that it's so far distanced from real people and the fact, right, that we said at the beginning, what we want to try and do is to allow people to be as free and as open, as entrepreneurial as they can be and get government, get the hell out of the way. And the last thing we want is a global dictate to say, thou shalt jump this way and we'll have to jump. I just don't buy that as anything like a future that I want to be part of. And yet, I think that we're sleepwalking into it. And I actually do believe that the COVID environment and the digitalization are both things that potentially can create a template that allows those things to be imposed on us more quickly and more deliberately than previously. So we need to guard our freedoms, right? And we need to actually really think local and act local and be entrepreneurial, because those are the things that actually created the societies that actually proved to be pretty good for quite a long time. And trying to impose a will centrally and say, jump this way and everything will be fine, trust us, we know, is nuts.
Yeah. And also, too, when you think about the problems of this tops-down approach from just looking at why communism failed, or one of the reasons communism failed, and there's just no price discovery. And without the data that you receive from prices, there's just no way an economy can function efficiently at all. And also, too, what I think is just so arrogant and disconnected with these people, these global elites we're talking about, is that regardless of what objective they want to pull off, it requires, they can't do it. They don't produce anything. They do is just sit there and they're just blowhards that just talk about things in ways that are just, that aren't very detailed. They're just kind of these, you know, these broad stroke statements that really don't mean anything, that really don't make any sense. No. And you're just supposed to kind of rally behind them. But at the end of the day, it's the individuals at the local level that have to execute for any game plan to come about. And so you have to ask yourself, how can we unleash the untapped power of the individual? How can we make sure that we set up an environment that's most conducive to those people doing what they can do? And it's probably an unpopular thing to say, but it's the honest truth in that I've been an employee, I've been an employer, and I'm 47 years old. And if I'm just looking at reality, and it's not to say that any human being is better or worse than another human being, but we all have our individual skills and our individual talents and our individual weaknesses. But I would go out there and say that the top, and I don't even want to call them the top, I'm going to say that the people who are capable of producing the most, and I'm going to say the top 10%, and it's not the top 10% of wealth, don't get me wrong. It's not the top 10% of income earners. It's definitely not the top 10% of students in university. That is for sure. It's just those individuals, the men and women who have the ambition, the ability to solve problems, the desire to just constantly get ahead where it's never enough. And they just have to keep pushing forward and forward. And they're working 80, 90 hours a week when they don't have to. And they're just, they're pushing the ball forward. And those are the people that drive society forward. And it just happens. I see it constantly. And I've had thousands of employees in my life before I retired in 2012. Now, I never had 1,000 employees at once. But if you look at the aggregate total of the employees I had, the last business had over 100 employees. So it wasn't huge by any means, but I've always owned and operated and started small to mid-sized businesses. But you see this clear as day, just clear as day, is that it's so hard to find a great employee, someone who will show up on time, that also can get along with people, for heaven's sakes, and has that ambition that they want to achieve more and more, and they want to start their own business. They want it so bad that they're willing to take really irrational risk with their money. And I'm saying that they're not just going and gambling at a roulette wheel. But if you think about what an entrepreneur does, it's when they could just get a 9-to-5 job and work a lot less and have a lot less gray hair, a lot fewer headaches, and but it just doesn't make them happy. So that type of individual, we want to be riding on their coattails, and we want to create an environment that allows them to do what they do, and we're all going to benefit as a result of that. You know, I'll use just myself as a quick example, and this isn't to brag or anything like that, but we talked about what I did prior to retirement, but what I do now with this YouTube channel and what I do with my real estate investing, and in 2019 I did that TV show. I produced a TV show in Medellin. But I've got probably 20 or 25 employees. That's in retirement, Martin. That's what I do when I retire and I'm on vacation and I want to enjoy life and have all this freedom and flexibility. I'm still creating 20, 30 jobs at a time. It's just what you do. It's kind of ingrained in your psyche. I'm sure you're the same way. But anyway, I'll get off my pedestal there. And I get for the viewers, I don't mean to brag. I'm just trying to prove a point that we need free markets. We need less regulation. We need to untap the power and the potential of the individual. And that's what's going to solve these problems. It's not a top-down approach from Klaus at the World Economic Forum.
Yeah, I agree. And what I find really interesting about this is that there's a concept of leadership, right, which basically says it's top-down, command, control, and there's lots of people below, right? There's another one that turns it on its head and say, no. Actually, leadership is like that. It should be enabling, facilitating, right? That is the change that we need, right? What we need to do is to recognize that actually it's the mass of people who can be enabled and freed to go do stuff, right? Leadership and government and all of those institutions should be supporting, not directing. That's the fundamental shift philosophically that I think we have to get to if we're going to be successful. And that is going to put a lot of senior leaders the nose out of joint, because they actually need to understand that they are there to facilitate, enable, and not command and control. That is the switch I think we need.
Yeah, I mean, you just summed up in 30 seconds what I was trying to say over the last 5 minutes. Not doing a very good job of it. Just digging myself a deeper hole, looking like this arrogant capitalist entrepreneur, greedy guy that I am. But, that reminds me of a Milton Friedman video that I was watching today, just doing some research for a whiteboard video I'm doing tomorrow. And he was on the Donahue show. I don't know if you recall that back in the late 70s, Donahue. For those of the younger viewers, Donahue was kind of the guy that preceded Oprah. He was kind of the daily talk show person, very, very famous. But and also what's kind of disturbing is the types of people that they have on talk shows today. It's these gals cheating on her husband with three other guys or something like that. And back in the 1970s, you got guys like Milton Friedman, Ayn Rand. You've got, it makes you wonder if we've kind of devolved a little bit as a society, to say the least. But anyway, so Friedman's on there, and Donahue was kind of a lefty, but he was a real smart guy, super smart guy. And he talked to Friedman about the exact same buzzwords you hear today about greed and have you ever second guessed capitalism? Because when you look around, it's just driven by this greed. And Friedman looks at him and he says, listen, show me a society or show me a system in today's society that isn't driven by greed. And of course, this was back in the 1970s. He said, you think communist Russia isn't driven by greed? You think China isn't driven by greed? Of course. We as human beings have this desire. It's just hardwired into our brain to pursue our own self-interest and the interests of our family. And nothing is going to change that. So the question really becomes, what system allows that to function? The hardwiring in the human brain, what system allows that to function at its highest potential? And if the viewers, if they haven't watched any of those clips from Friedman on Donahue, you got to check that out, because it's priceless.
Yeah. And the point to make, and maybe this is where we sort of close this off today, is we're talking here about the fundamental tenets of evolution, right? Because in fact, evolution is always been and always will be. It's the survival of the fittest. It's those who can, will do, and will survive. Now, we obviously need support mechanisms in place because we want to be the best society we can be. But if we try and turn that off and say somehow we're going to dictate everything from the top and somebody's going to say, thou shalt jump here, and so we have to, we've basically lost something fundamental about an elemental about the way that humanity is and the way that we are. And that cannot ever be turned off. So, time to perhaps do an alt-control-delete reset on the way we think about economics and the way we think about society. Because frankly, if we don't do that, we're going to end up in a dictatorial future where we have no personal freedom, where everything is being dictated from afar. And frankly, that, I think, stops us being human.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And I would say we just don't need a reset. We got to go back to what we know works well. And it's just very limited government. It's where, you know, all these problems that they talk about in today, as far as lobbyists, that's a great example that I always like to use. They say, well, oh my gosh, these lobbyists, we've got to get rid of them. We've got to control. We need more government to regulate these lobbyists. No, we don't. We just have to shrink the size of government. If the federal government didn't have any power, we wouldn't have any lobbyists trying to manipulate the power. It's just so many things are solved by reducing the size of government to where it's just making sure we have rule of law, you're protecting the society, and you've got private property rights, and you eliminate the central bank. You have solid, you got hard money that you can count on, you can depend on, and you have a very small size of the federal government, and you let the states compete with one another. I think all you have to do is just go back to that, and you're going to see huge improvements. And that's how we get out of these big problems that we're in right now. It's not from our monetary mandarins, as Jim Grant always says at the central banks.
George, I appreciate your time today. It's been a fascinating conversation. And as always, we seem to have a heated agreement, which is a bit of a worry, but very fascinating. And take care. Be safe over there. Don't get blown away.
Thanks a lot, Martin. Can't wait to do it again, buddy.
Cheers. Take care.